Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the public humiliation of Attorney General Jeff Sessions by his boss Donald Trump, who told the New York Times that he would not have hired Sessions had he known Sessions was going to recuse himself from the Russia investigation. David Graham, a staff writer for The Atlantic, where he has an article, The Inadvisable President, joins us to discuss the one-way street of loyalty in the Trump White House, where Trump expects absolute loyalty while everyone around him, except for perhaps his family, are disposable. And in an Oval Office with the opposite message of Harry Truman's that the buck stops here, if underlings are not blamed for everything that goes wrong, they are at the mercy of a man who made himself famous as the gleeful executioner of jobs and careers with his power play pronouncement, "You're fired." Then we look into the deteriorating situation in Venezuela, where today's national strike has paralyzed a country on the brink of economic collapse and social chaos. David Smildy, a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, who has studied Venezuela for 25 years and curates a blog, Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights, joins us to discuss how much the embattled and unpopular President Maduro is in control of a country he is systematically turning into a Cuban-style pseudo-democracy. We will assess what other centers of power exist with deep-rooted Cuban influence over the intelligence and military services, as well as the power of cartels in the lucrative drug trade and the corrupt former Chavez loyalists who have become the new oligarchs. Then finally, following the diagnosis that Senator John McCain has a virulent form of brain cancer, we will assess the possibility that Arizona will have two Senate races in 2018, with both the junior Senator Jeff Flake, who is up for re-election, and successors to John McCain on the ballot. Evan Wyloge, an investigative reporter with the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting, joins us to discuss how the White House is already gunning for Jeff Flake, who Trump hates, and what a prolonged absence of Senator McCain will mean for the narrow Republican lead in the Senate. And joining us now is David Graham, a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers political and global news. He previously reported for Newsweek, The Wall Street Journal, and The National. And his latest article at The Atlantic is The Inadvisable President. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Graham.
Thank you for having me.
And as your article points out, it should be no surprise to people that the man most famous for firing people is not a good boss. But publicly humiliating your attorney general, as he has done in the New York Times interview, the failing New York Times, as he likes to call it. Nevertheless, he gave them a pretty exclusive interview in the Oval Office and seemed, according to them, to be pretty chipper. But going after this man, I mean, how much humiliation do you think Sessions can endure? Because today he said at a press conference announcing the closing down of some dark web operations that he had no intention of resigning. But it's got to be publicly humiliating for him, surely.
I can't imagine. I mean, I can't recall any example of a president, recent or historical, going after their own attorney general in this kind of way. He's gone after the Justice Department before, but this is something else. And, you know, we heard reports back in June that Sessions had offered to resign after Trump was complaining about him quite a bit, and Trump rejected the resignation. So you wonder what would make him stick around still when he's being trashed to the press like this.
Well, but he seems to need people to trash. He obviously needs Obama. He needs Hillary Clinton. He doesn't take responsibility for anything and blames everything on others. So is that a part of this pattern then? You keep people around so you've got people to blame?
It might be. I mean, throughout the interview, you see him trying to compare himself to other people, whether it's Obama or Hillary or Emmanuel Macron or you name it. That's how he works, is he compares himself to other people and he puts them down in comparison to himself.
So what do you think's going on, though, in terms of Stephen Miller, who was brought in by Jeff Sessions and is now one of Trump's top key advisors, along with Sebastian Gorka and Stephen Bannon? At least that's what we understand.
That's something I've been thinking about all day, and I haven't managed to get anything on it, but I think it's exactly the right question. You know, Miller was an aide to Sessions. He was originally loaned to the Trump campaign, then became close to Trump, and He seems to have become closer to Jared Kushner since he joined the administration, maybe as a solidifying his position sort of move. But it's got to be very strange, at the very least, to see the president bashing your former mentor like that.
Well, I think if you want to stay in your job in the White House or get ahead, you befriend Jared Kushner, right?
Well, Kushner's now potential. I mean, you know, we hear stories about Kushner being on the outs. He's subject to investigations by the FBI and Robert Mueller as well. So I don't know if it's a safe position, but it's certainly a good place to be for the time being.
But as far as we know, the source of Trump's anger at Sessions, and he made this pretty clear in the New York Times interview, is that somehow by recusing himself, the Russian investigation got away from him, and now Trump can't shut it down.
Right. Trump wants more than anything to find a way to shut that down. He would like to have had Sessions do it. He would like Rosenstein to do it. He tried to get James Comey to kill the Flynn investigation at the very least. And I think he's realized now that it's very hard for him to fire Robert Mueller, although he keeps asserting that it's something he could do. And that's got to be very frustrating because he understands the danger that it poses.
But you mentioned that he sort of indicated that he could even fire Mueller, and that was specifically about a red line that he said Mueller would cross if he went after his family. But we learned today from Bloomberg that Mueller is looking into the family finances, particularly Russian investments in Trump businesses.
Yeah, that Bloomberg report is interesting, and I think it bears a little bit of closer parsing and maybe more reporting, because that was family business involved in Russia, and Trump, in his quote, seemed to be saying it was business outside of Russia that would set off alarm bells for him. But, what you know, these businesses are all transcontinental or transnational. There's financing in various places. They cross national lines. So it's hard to see how an investigation started in Russia would remain only in Russia.
Right. But a man who's at the center of a lot of questions and a lot of investigations and who has not done anything to clear the air on the Russian situation, if anything, he has doubled down. And now we're learning, you know, from people like McMaster in the White House that they keep having to do damage control because Trump continually tries to make deals with Putin. And he just made a deal with Putin to kill the CIA-funded Free Syrian Army. So, and that's got John McCain really upset. So it's an extraordinary situation and it doesn't change. So when Trump says to the New York Times, this is my red line with Mueller, I'll fire him if he does this, isn't that like a red flag to Mueller? That's where I should be going after the evidence. I mean, that's the way I'd see it.
It seems like, yeah, absolutely.
And do you think that there's a chance that Mueller, he's not going to be intimidated, but I wouldn't count out Trump firing Mueller, would you?
I wouldn't. And you know, he keeps threatening to do it without saying so explicitly. But I don't know how else to read what he said there. He's clearly threatening Mueller with firing. And today the White House asserted very clearly that he's not going to, but he has the right to do so, which again reads like a threat to fire Mueller.
And again, I'm speaking with David Graham, who's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers political and global news. He previously reported for Newsweek, The Wall Street Journal, and The National. And his latest article at The Atlantic is The Inadvisable President. So if this is what the real issue is here, trying to get out from underneath the Russian investigation, of course, if he fired Mueller, I think that would be like the Saturday Night Massacre. And it would probably even stir the Republicans into having to show some backbone. But going back to Sessions, it all started, his recusal, which Trump doesn't seem to have any concept of the rules in the judiciary and in the law about recusal. I recall it all came from Senator Al Franken's question, did it not, in the confirmation hearing of Sessions, that he set him up and Sessions, you could say he lied, but maybe he didn't remember the meeting with the Russian ambassador, etc. But it's pretty clear, everybody that knows anything about the law and legal circles, that Sessions didn't have any choice, did he, but to recuse himself.
Right. He had to. I mean, he you know, here he is acting as a campaign surrogate. He met with the Russians, so he's implicated in the investigation potentially. He has failed to disclose it to Congress, whether that was intentionally or unintentionally. And now he's facing a potential. There are Democratic senators calling for him to be brought up on perjury charges. It was the only option he had. And in this interview, Trump seems to show no recognition of why that was a problem or why Sessions felt like he had to recuse himself.
Right, but in the interview in the New York Times, Trump completely contradicted what James Comey said in his public testimony about the meeting that took place where Trump shooed Sessions out of the room along with Jared and then tried to talk Comey into going easy on Flynn. So when it comes to a crunch, won't the special prosecutor have an easy time of that by asking Sessions, were you kicked out of the room or not?
I mean, right, there's all those people who are in the room can answer that they were kicked out. And you've got the Comey memos, which are seem to be a fairly credible source against Trump saying he can't recall. Here you have a detailed recollection versus somebody saying, I don't remember this meeting. It seems like a fairly clear bias in favor of the Comey account.
Right. So we're heading in that direction, right? It's not unreasonable to assume that when it comes down to Trump's word versus Comey's, I think most people that know Comey, it's a slam dunk. And most people ought to have figured out that Donald Trump's a serial liar. But when it comes to evidence, I mean, this is the thing about him. He keeps digging the hole for himself, does he not, with his tweets, with his public statement, with his interview with Lester Holt, and so forth. It's extraordinary. And now the New York Times interview.
I can't imagine how his lawyers feel reading this sort of thing where he does continue to dig the hole and continues to contradict himself or continues to validate the things his critics say, which just only builds the case against him.
So going back to the interview with the New York Times, it wasn't just Sessions that he dumped on. He dumped on all of the people in the DOJ at the top levels. He went after Rod Rosenstein and he kept saying he was a Democrat from Baltimore, where there's no Republicans. Well, it turns out he's a Republican from, what, Chevy Chase or somewhere in the...
Bethesda,
right. And then he went after the acting FBI director and, of course, Sessions and Mueller, the special prosecutor, and of course, Comey, who's no longer there. But still, there's nobody in the top ranks of the DOJ that he hasn't gone after. I mean, he's at war with all of them, just as he's at war with the intelligence services and the State Department. Maybe you're there in Washington, David. You can tell us a few more government departments he's at war with.
He's at war with the State Department over the crisis with Qatar. He keeps taking the Saudi side while the State Department is taking a more friendly side to Qatar and trying to resolve the conflict. Trump exacerbates it. You have Russia issues. You mentioned this earlier, where he continues to cozy up to Russia over the recommendations of his foreign policy advisors, including H.R. McMaster. You have him attacking the Justice Department on various legal strategies outside of this. It's hard to think of a major department he has not clashed with in ways. And he seems to not understand that he is the boss. I mean, he could fire Jeff Sessions. Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general who he went after, is somebody he nominated for the post. And yet here he is talking about him like he's some random guy who was foisted upon the Trump administration.
So that's quite a list of people he could fire, right? Mueller, Rosenstein, Sessions. I mean, Mueller would be the big one. That would really set off a lot of alarm bells. But what are the chances of him going after somebody else? Or in particular?
I think a Rosenstein firing would set off a lot of alarm bells, too, because Rosenstein is the acting attorney general on the Russia issues and seems to be, by rule, if not by law, the person who would be in line to fire Robert Mueller. Firing Jeff Sessions would cause a lot of problems because he is the attorney general. But also, you know, I think he's a Trump insider and wouldn't necessarily have a ton of defenders if he were fired. One wonders about somebody like H.R. McMaster, who seems to continually clash with the president and who the president has reportedly complained about in private. He's someone who has a lot of cachet outside the White House. Firing him would raise a lot of alarm bells, not least with Republicans in Congress. But, you know, these top officials who are his guys, you wonder why they stick around when he's criticizing them, and you wonder why he doesn't fire them when he seems so angry at them.
Well, we know from Comey's testimony that he demands loyalty, absolute loyalty, and then poor Comey, the best he could say, well, I can promise you honest loyalty. But you recall the recent photo op in the cabinet room where every member of the cabinet and all of his White House advisors, they went round the big table And they all had this sycophantic praise for what a wonderful leader he was and what a privilege it is to serve him. And the only one sitting at that table that wasn't disgusting was General Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, who praised the men and women in uniform in the United States. But that was an extraordinary display of this expectation or this demand that Trump has for absolute personal loyalty. But surely these people must know that that's a one-way street, that he'll hang them out to dry in a heartbeat.
And he has done so repeatedly. I mean, he keeps contradicting. He's contradicted the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Treasury, the press secretary, and the vice president, all in very public fashion, just in the last couple months.
Right. I recall, though, with the Secretary of the Treasury, who's sort of unctuous kind of toady to begin with, he was the one who came out and announced what a great deal had come out of the Putin-Trump G20 meeting, that they were going to work together on cybersecurity, which is absolutely amazing to think that the country that hacked into the U.S. elections, you could work with them on cybersecurity. And Mnuchin goes out there and sells this wonderful new cooperation on cybersecurity. But the next day, Trump decided to pull the whole idea.
It wasn't even the next day. It was that evening he tweeted saying that he was pulling the plug on it. And, you know, you put your credibility out trying to defend the president on these issues, and the president has no interest in sticking with them and no likelihood of doing it. It's got to be demoralizing to work for him.
But he seems to have a little more loyalty to his own family, right? And they seem to be almost like the Stepford children. They're sort of living in this kind of almost like a cult. One of the biographies of Trump said it is kind of runs like a cult. I mean, that's his background, right? Running a private company, a family company, not any kind of public company. And that's the extent of his business experience. So is there any difference between the way he treats his family and the way he treats the rest of them?
Well, so far there seems to be. And I was thinking about his biography and where he has broken with family in the past. We know there was a time after his divorce from Ivanka Trump that he and Donald Trump Jr. were not speaking. There was a story we know about him trying to cut off insurance to his brother's son when he was a baby over a conflict in the family. There are stories about him, for example, leaving Marla Maples on the tarmac as he took off because she was late for a flight. So he's sometimes been fairly harsh with family, but it's less so with his children specifically. And so they seem, and Jared Kushner by extension, seem to have a different sort of status. It was notable when he was angry at Jared Kushner for some mishandling of issues a couple months ago. But even now, Kushner hasn't had his security clearance revoked, despite the questions about the 100-plus meetings that he failed to disclose on his application.
So then what about this one-way street in terms of loyalty? How does it sit with the House and the Senate? Now we know from the book about Bannon that Bannon says some pretty choice things about Paul Ryan. But what's happening now with this health care bill seems to be, you know, where he hauls the entire Republican Senate into lunch at the White House, and I think that was just before he actually met with the New York Times people. He then humiliates or threatens the senator from Nevada, one of the wayward senators. But basically then, after making all kinds of confusing and contradictory suggestions about how to move forward on repeal and replacement of Obamacare, basically gave them their marching orders saying, get it done, you know, don't go on vacation. And then later, Mitch McConnell did a brief statement in the White House grounds where he more or less, I think he's just going to, you know, have the vote, and then we know the vote's not going to happen, and walk away from it. I don't think that these people in the Senate in particular are particularly loyal to him, because he sort of treats them almost like he doesn't help them in any way. He doesn't help sell like Obama did, you know, even though people say he didn't do a good job on selling Obamacare. He was a hands-on all the way. He seems like an absentee landlord and then makes all kinds of weird conflicting advice through these random Twitter storms, and then more or less tells them, gives them their marching orders and expects miracles.
Right. You know, there's a lot of focus on the way that congressional Republicans aren't doing a great deal to hold Trump accountable. And I think that's true. But we can already see through this that they don't take him very seriously either. I mean, many of them bucked him on health care. They clearly were not concerned about serious consequences for that. And even if they were, they weren't going to do it. He just doesn't have a lot of sway with them already. And one wonders what it would take for him to regain influence with these Republican senators.
Well, David Graham, I thank you for joining us, and let's stay in touch. It's bizarre.
Thank you for having me.
As this bizarre presidency continues to make people like you work hard, right?
That's right. Plenty to work on.
And again, I've been speaking with David Graham, a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers political and global news. He previously reported for Newsweek, The Wall Street Journal, and The National. And his latest article at The Atlantic is The Inadvisable President. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the deteriorating situation in Venezuela, where today's national strike has paralyzed a country on the brink of economic collapse and social chaos. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Smildy, who's the Charles A. and Leo M. Favreau Professor of Human Relations at Tulane University and a senior fellow at the Washington Office on Latin America. He has studied Venezuela for 25 years and has written and edited 3 books on the country, and he curates a blog called Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights, and he's testified to the United States Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Smildy.
Thank you for calling, Ian.
And the television pictures you see of Venezuela today, with the general strike taking place by the opposition in a last-ditch move to head off a power grab by President Nicolas Maduro, burning tires, deserted streets, tear gas. You know, the government has its colectivos, these vigilante groups roaming around, and you've got all these young kids, I think about 100 of them have been killed so far, facing up to the riot police and their cannons and tear gas, etc. But it sort of has a feeling that this is a country on the brink. What's your take on it?
Well, it certainly is. You know, the thing is that we've been saying that for a couple of years now. It always seems like it's on the brink, and it just keeps going on. You know, sometimes it's a little bit hard to keep people's interest in what's going on in Venezuela, because just one conflict after another, and it never seems to lead to any kind of resolution. But today was somewhat different in the sense that it was a general strike, and it was largely observed by the population. I think the opposition coalition can't complain. Most businesses were closed, but only banks and government offices and a handful of businesses were open today. And the citizenry actually went beyond the general strike, and in many places, on their own accord, shut down neighborhoods and major streets. And so Caracas today was basically shut down. And I think that was true of a lot of the country. Of course, the closer you are to the sort of the urban middle class areas of Venezuela, the more this paro cívico or this general strike was observed. When you get to, you know, the rural areas and the poorer barrios, I think there's probably less observation of this general strike. But in general, it seems to have been a success.
But so far, Maduro has completely ignored the opposition, marginalized them. He's even sent his thugs, the colectivos, into the assembly to beat up all of the Congress members. And he's got a Supreme Court that's essentially a puppet operation, a rubber stamp. And the only person that seems to be standing up to him is the Attorney General, and they're really going after her. So it's hard to see that the opposition have any political gains, and it doesn't seem that Maduro's any way interested in compromise. And he doesn't seem to be aware of the fact that his citizens are in absolute pain and that he's a complete incompetent and a disgrace. And there he is on television dancing, and he has his own TV and radio show. You know, I mean, what a joke. So what's going on? Is there somebody else running that country behind the scenes?
Well, you know, I don't think so. That's what people always say, that Maduro is just a figurehead, and that it's really armed forces and other people that are behind him running the country. You know, to a certain extent, it's true in the sense that there are a lot of different powers that are behind him and a lot of vested interests that want to keep things the way they are. But Maduro is actually in a very powerful position. I mean, Hugo Chavez basically spent 14 years concentrating power in the position of the presidency, and Maduro has inherited that. So he has, on his own accord, any number of times marginalized people that, you know, were pressuring for a different direction or for some kind of economic change. So Maduro, I think, actually has more control than people think. I do think he's somebody that's not a capable president. He's not somebody that has a real degree of reflection and the ability to reorient himself and really give a reading of what's going on. I think a lot of the really absurd distortions, the economic distortions we see, are largely his doing. I think a lot of the government would have gone along if he had tried to reform, but he fundamentally does not understand economics. So, I mean, currently in the current situation, indeed, the opposition has been for 110 days protesting. There's been 100 deaths. They've paid a high cost, and they're making a real push, and that's because they're facing an existential threat. You know, this constitutional assembly, this constituent assembly, I should say, that Maduro has called is something that would, I think, completely wipe the opposition off the map. It would, you know, change the whole nature of the state. I think it would no longer would be a democracy in the normal way we think of it, a federal system of national government, state government, municipal government, and universal direct vote. It would be something more like a Soviet democratic centralism, a sort of corporatist pyramid, starting with communal councils and going all the way up to the president. So I think, they're fighting. And, of course, you wouldn't necessarily expect somebody in Maduro's position to really concede until he actually has to, So I'm sure they're aware that the situation is pretty grim and that the opposition is pushing really hard. And, in this type of situation, change happens when it happens. It's hard to really know from the beginning because people are not going to let on because part of their power is making their power seem inevitable.
And again, I'm speaking with David Smiley, who's the Charles A. and Leo M. Favreau Professor of Human Relations at Tulane University and a senior fellow at the Washington Office on Latin America. He has studied Venezuela for 25 years and has written or edited 3 books on the country, and he curates a blog called Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights and has testified before the United States Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Well, I was watching TV last night, David, and I saw a piece on Venezuela where people in droves were crossing the bridges into Colombia, and they've been going across the border for a long time, selling gasoline, etc., on the black market. But these were people that were literally giving up on their own country, and I guarantee you these are not wealthy people. These are the kind of people that the Bolivarian Revolution is supposed to have helped, and many of them had tears in their eyes. It was hurting them so much to leave their own country, but they simply could not survive. It seems to have reached that point. So you have a kind of new oligarchy. It seems that you've got the sort of the Chavez oligarchy, you've got the drug smugglers, and you got the Cubans. I mean, I'm trying to break down this power behind the scenes. You alluded to it. But what is the role of the Cubans? Because we know that Maduro was educated in Cuba, and he doesn't seem like the brightest bulb. And if they're behind the scenes, I believe the former head of Cuban intelligence has a very prominent role there in Caracas. And the SEBIN, the Bolivarian National Intelligence Service, and the Military Intelligence Service seems to be heavily influenced, if not controlled, by the Cubans. And you've got the former Minister of Defense in custody, General Raul Baduel, for criticizing the Cubans. So what's going on with the Cubans? Are they really running the show?
I don't think so. There's a long tradition within sort of opposition criticism and commentary about the situation saying that that the decisions are made in Havana, that Venezuela is actually a client state of Cuba. And, you know, I think all of that is exaggerated in the sense that Cuba is much more dependent on Venezuela and Venezuelan oil than vice versa. No, Cuba needs Venezuela more than Venezuela needs Cuba. But, as you mentioned, Maduro was educated in Cuba, and the people that are in Maduro's inner core see Cuba as sort of like their mentor, as like their experienced big brother, and they pay close attention to what they say politically, and they go to them for advice. And I think a lot of the tactics that we've seen in terms of development of intelligence, of controlling the military, of how to police social upheaval, I think there's a lot of Cuban influence there. And so I think Cubans have a really big impact. I mean, right now, there's some interesting moves. Juan Manuel Santos from Colombia was in Cuba this week, and one of the things he wanted to talk about was the possibility of Cuba participating in some sort of negotiations with Venezuela. I think that that's probably quite unlikely, because I think you know, Cuba would have no interest in that, and I think, you know, Cuba has a great interest in this constituent assembly going forward, and Venezuela becoming another sort of revolutionary pseudo-democracy in the region that could be, you know, a strong ally, an ally with oil. And so I think Cuba has no real motivation for that. I think, you know, you can imagine in certain circumstances things really deteriorate. Cuba could provide a key role by providing safe haven for Maduro and his inner circle. That's something that could defuse the conflict and provide a real service. But as far as actually, you know, fomenting or participating in negotiations, I'm hard to see what Cuba's motivation would be.
But in these circumstances where a country is literally falling apart, in this case it's an oil-rich country, so there's hardly an excuse for how a country with the world's second biggest reserves of oil could be in such disarray and on the brink of bankruptcy, where there are no medicines and the food supplies are intermittent at best and staples are not available and people are angry and they're taken to the streets. And I believe this, that, you know, without accurate polling, there's something like 85% of the people of Venezuela want this Maduro out. They're sick of this. So something's keeping him in power. And then you always assume in these circumstances that the military will step in. And of course, Chavez himself, back in 1992, as a military officer, staged a coup. So Latin America is not unfamiliar with coups. So the expectation that under these dire circumstances, patriotic colonels will show up and save the day, my understanding is that that's not likely to happen in Venezuela. You know, whether it's a good idea or not is beside the point. It's just not likely to happen simply because the military have been basically infiltrated by the Cubans.
Well, I think more than that, the Cubans have advised on how to create a loyal military. And so for 18 years, the government has weeded out people that are not seen as loyal, has built, basically promoted people based on their loyalty. And, you know, in the past 4 years of the Maduro government, Maduro has made it a top priority and has given the military all kinds of goodies, has given them ever more space within the government, given them control over citizen security, given them a television station, a bank. Now they have control over all the imports of food and distribution in the country. And so all of these things are lucrative opportunities for corruption and kickbacks. And so, yeah, I don't, you know, it doesn't seem promising that there would be any kind of you know, military involvement or military stepping in and say, hey, we're going to have elections. You know, it just doesn't seem, you know, anything can happen, but it seems like, you know, they've had a long time to sort of prune and train this military to be absolutely loyal. And Maduro, you know, for a long time, many of us were watching closely the behavior of the defense minister, Vladimir Padrino Lopez, who some people thought could have reason to separate from the National Guard or separate from the government, and in fact made some critical comments about the National Guard. He's from the normal services, from the Army, who's not involved in policing the protests and not involved in corruption. But Maduro made some changes, and no longer has Padrino Lopez as the defense minister, no longer has him as control, sort of as like a joint chief of staff of the armed forces. And so his power is reduced now. And so he has, Maduro has sort of artfully balanced different military people against each other. So at this point, it does not seem likely that the military would have that kind of role.
Well, of course, President Trump has threatened sanctions against Venezuela if they go down the Cuban path and essentially turn themselves into a Soviet-style pseudo-democracy. And we have this outrageously incompetent and dangerous and ignorant president. So I have no faith in him, and I don't imagine the Venezuelan people do. I should think that anything that Trump did would backfire enormously, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, he's not popular at all here. I think, you know, in terms of the sanctions, you know, I think the sanctions, there's a couple different possibilities of sanctions. One is the existing legislation that was sponsored by Marco Rubio that provides for targeted sanctions. That legislation was rolled out in 2015 and used on seven different individuals. And the idea there of that kind of those kind of sanctions is to sanction certain individuals, freezing their assets in the United States, blocking their visas, and that would serve as some sort of example for other officials in the government. And that, you know, that sounds like a really clever idea, but when you look at how it works on the ground, it might have that impact, making some officials think twice. But it also creates this cadre of ultra-loyal officials who suddenly see themselves as, see their futures as synonymous with the future of this government. And so the seven people that were sanctioned in 2015 were all promoted. They were all given high-level positions in the security apparatus or in state industries. This year, Tariq El-Aissami, the vice president, was sanctioned as well, and he has since then has been absolutely faithful radical and has been part of this real authoritarian push. No, the supporters of sanctions point precisely to the attorney general that you mentioned before, Luis Ortega, and say, well, there's an example of how sanctions could work, and you know, it got her to think and separate herself from the regime. But then if you look at it closely, well, all of her actions have been blocked by the Supreme Court, which has a core of six justices that themselves were sanctioned, and the government and that Supreme Court now is trying to replace her with Catherine Harrington, who is somebody who was sanctioned in 2015. And so you can see all these things, these sanctions might have some effects, but they also have opposite and probably unequal effects on the people who themselves are sanctioned, who become key players in the regime. So the Trump administration has also talked about, floated the specter of economic sanctions, of sanctioning the oil industry. Now, that would be an absolute disaster in Venezuela because, you know, this is a country, you know, both Marco Rubio and Luis Almagro of the OAS have said, oh, this would not cause any kind of human cost. But if you look at the numbers, you know, Venezuela, 95% of its foreign earnings come from oil exports, and it imports over 70% of its food. And so, you know, sanctioning the oil industry would probably cause massive starvation in Venezuela and probably cause a refugee crisis, you know, because it would have such an incredible impact. I think it would also, you know, bring countries in the region into solidarity with Venezuela, and I think probably would lead Venezuela to develop much closer ties with Russia. And so I think that would be an absolute disaster of a policy. I hope they're just floating it as a sort of threat and don't plan on actually doing it. But, you know, it's something that is definitely on the table.
Well, David Smalley, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
All right, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Smalley, who's the Charles A. and Leo M. Favreau Professor of Human Relations at Tulane University and a senior fellow at the Washington Office on Latin America. He has studied Venezuela for 25 years and has written or edited three books on the country, and he curates a blog called Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights and has testified before the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the possibility that Arizona will have two U.S. Senate races in 2018. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Evan Wyloge, who's an investigative reporter with the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting, who covers politics and government in Arizona with a focus on watchdog data and accountability journalism. He previously spent 5 years as a reporter at the Arizona Capital Times. Welcome to Background Briefing, Evan Wyloge.
Thank you for having me.
And we could have an extraordinary situation in Arizona, given the health of Senator McCain, although he obviously is a fighter, as everybody says he is. He's nevertheless has a really serious problem, a health challenge with a very virulent form of brain cancer. So, you know, if he were to resign within this year, Arizonans would have two separate Senate contests on their ballots in 2018. With Jeff Flake, of course, the state's junior senator, who's already under a lot of pressure from Donald Trump, who hates him. He's up for re-election next year. And there may also be somebody having to fill out or compete for Senator McCain's seat. So what's the local feeling now in Arizona of the, obviously, one doesn't want to be sort of ghoulish and not respect the fact that the senator has serious health problems, but to be realistic, he is facing some serious health challenges.
Yeah, well, I think you've summarized the situation pretty well. He is a fighter. Everybody knows that. Everybody who knows the guy usually feels like they are walking away from a warm conversation. He's a nice guy. He's a good guy to talk to. So it's understandable that everybody is sending their wishes to him. But nonetheless, this is a very serious condition. It's the same kind of cancer that took Ted Kennedy and Beau Biden as well. So there's a history of it, and it's a low survival kind of cancer. So given that, of course, people have already started talking here locally about what kinds of things might happen. If he were to decide at some point, maybe in the next several weeks to months, that it would be best if he stepped down, then we'd be in a position where the governor of Arizona, Doug Ducey, would be able to appoint somebody to fill out the seat until the next election, which is next year. And so, like you said, that would leave us with two Senate elections in 2018, which would really scramble your normal Senate election politics. You know, it's hard to imagine what kinds of calculations would be made by people in terms of which primary to one run in and what those dynamics would be, because you'd have two Democratic primaries, two Republican primaries, and then the two general elections. So it would be quite extraordinary. It would probably turn Arizona into a real epicenter for Senate politics in 2018. If you want to take this a couple degrees further and kind of how crazy things could get, you've got a situation that people have been talking about on social media just today, where Doug Ducey could find a way to end up appointing himself, whether that's either through directly appointing himself to the seat or by making some kind of arrangement with the Secretary of State, who's the next in line for the governor's office, where he could resign his position, she would appoint him, and then he would have the benefit of a small incumbency heading into that election for 2018 to fill in the next 4 years. So it would be a four-year term for replacing Senator McCain if that's the direction things go for next year.
But short of that, if the senator decides to stay in the Senate, he'll be having chemotherapy, which is pretty debilitating. He won't probably be as active as he has been. That in itself is going to create problems for the narrow Republican majority in the Senate, is it not? Already, his absence from this key healthcare vote is being felt by Mitch McConnell.
Sure. You can only imagine how many times the national establishment within the Republican Party will be willing to try to get something passed when they've got one person out, and it's only a 51-48 Senate dynamic instead of the 52-48 that they're thinking that they can come in any legislative battle on their side.
So again, I'm speaking with Evan Wyloge, who's an investigative reporter with the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting, who covers politics and government in Arizona with a focus on watchdog data and accountability journalism. And he previously spent 5 years as a reporter at the Arizona Capital Times. Now, Evan, the already there's a pretty nasty Senate race shaping up there for the junior Senate, is there not, Jeff Flake? And while one of the Democrats running in the primary to challenge him is getting some pretty nasty attacks because she's a Muslim, which Senator Flake, he has defended her. It seems that Flake's really in Trump's crosshairs, is he not? Trump's really mad at him for publicly going out against Trump when the release of those Access Hollywood tapes of Trump's boorish, misogynistic outlook on life and treatment of women. And that apparently infuriated Trump. But my understanding is that in terms of the candidates that are lining up, there's Kelly Ward, Robert Graham, former GOP state chair for Trump, and then there's also the state treasurer, Jeff DeWitt, who apparently David Bossie, one of Trump's close advisors, the head of Citizens United and Trump's deputy campaign manager, he wants to throw a lot of money at DeWitt. So let's talk a little bit about Jeff Flake's re-election prospects. First of all, is it an open primary? I mean, in other words, could the Republicans primary Flake by running somebody further to the right than he is, if indeed the Republicans in Arizona tend to vote right?
Well, we already have Kelly Ward, who has committed to running against Flake. I think that right now, Robert Graham, the former chairman of the party here in the state, I think as far as he's gotten is just talking to people, lining up donors, that kind of thing. I don't know that he's actually announced that he was going to do anything, but there's certainly been a lot of rumors for sure about whether or not he might make a run for the seat. I think that both of them would be further to the right than Jeff Flake, but Kelly Ward really staked out that territory pretty well when she was in the state legislature here in Arizona and then when she ran against Senator McCain last year. And that primary election, she lost. I think she got about 30% of the vote, which is not nothing. That's a considerable portion of the vote. However, Arizona has been solidly Republican but also moderate at a statewide level for a long time. You see that reflected in the gubernatorial races and the Senate races. So while there is a wing of the Republican Party that is pretty far right and they do run candidates for a lot of these offices, they haven't been successful really yet. So I think the deck is already stacked against someone like Kelly Ward, but you know, it might be interesting to see if she outpaces her performance against Senator McCain from last year. If Robert Graham were to get into the race, I think that he would bring a lot of the maybe dissatisfied establishment people who are not real far right, but also don't really care for the longtime establishment candidates. Maybe something looking in the middle right there. Hopefully that makes some sense. But it would be interesting to see, especially if you've got a Jeff Flake primary and something were to happen where you'd have a second primary as well because of what might happen with John McCain, would you be setting up Robert Graham to go run in that other primary? And so you can imagine all kinds of scenarios, all kinds of matchups that might come of this new development.
Well, I think the broader question, though, would be in terms of Jeff Flake's prospects. Since Trump has made it so clear that he's going after him, it would be a contest between Trump and Flake in Arizona, and the little guy standing up against the big bully, and Trump is becoming increasingly unpopular. So being Trump's enemy may actually end up helping Flake.
It sure could. It might. That would be the case if Jeff DeWitt were to run, let's say. And that situation is a little odd because he's talked about the possibility. He's also said he's not running for treasurer again, even though he's not termed out yet. So everybody's kind of waiting to hear what he announces in terms of the next step for himself. But if he were to run, he would definitely be the candidate preferred by President Trump. He's a longtime President Trump supporter. He was there early on. He went on TV and was a loyal spokesperson for the president during the campaign. I believe he's continued to do so since. And so he's got a lot of acquaintances. So there's a lot of ties between the White House and him and his allies here. So if that were to happen, it would be really interesting. But like you said, perhaps that plays in the favor of Senator Flake. It is plausible to imagine those trends continue and the president becomes more unpopular over time, and somebody standing up to him and his allies would be more successful.
So McCain himself, of course, has got a bit of a reputation of being independent, along with his friend Lindsey Graham. They've been critical of Trump's foreign policy and his coziness with the Russians, fairly consistently so. And in fact, just today, Donald Trump tweeted out his criticism of President Trump's canceling of a covert U.S. CIA program to the so-called moderate rebels in Syria. And McCain accused Trump of, quote, playing right into the hands of Vladimir Putin. So being sort of independent of Trump is also working for McCain, is it not?
Well, sure. I think that's been a position that McCain has enjoyed for a long time. He's like an institution in the Senate and has been for a while. So that affords him the ability to criticize people within his own party. And he's got that reputation, like you said. I think a lot of people know him for that reputation.
Right, but you recall early in the presidential campaign, Donald Trump made the most outrageous comments about McCain. He's not a war hero to me. I prefer my heroes who aren't captured. I mean, I'm trying to remember exactly what he said, but along those lines, you know. And we know that McCain had a pretty rough time as a prisoner in North Vietnam. So how did that play in Arizona? I mean, you've got these Trump people running against Flake and possibly running in McCain's seat if he were to step down. What's the general attitude? I mean, have people forgiven and forget? Are they tribal? Do they just support Trump because he's a Republican? I mean, I would have thought that.
Well, I think you're onto something with them being tribal, but I think that there are sub-tribes, if you will, within the Republican Party, because the same people who would support that far-right candidate like Kelly Ward are the same people who are your die-hard Trump supporters and critics, you know, longtime critics of Senator McCain. You know, they think that he's not far enough to the right, and they've always had this minority within the Republican Party that's felt that way, but it's been a solid subgroup within the Republican Party. So I think that you have a lot of people here who are mainstream Republicans who, if it came down to how they felt about, you know, what Donald Trump said during the campaign as a candidate, that they would not appreciate that. Some people here would appreciate that. And that is, I think, kind of you're going to see that'll be your dividing line for issues of are you to the right far enough sufficiently, or are you too moderate, or are you mainstream and you view those as the wackos?
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, let's turn to we've been talking about the two Republican senators and their chances in the re-election and the possibility of John McCain stepping down. On the Democratic side, Deidre Abood is running in the Democratic primary for the seat held by Senator Jeff Flake. She's been attacked by cyberbullies because she's a Muslim, and Jeff Flake has come to her defense. So are there any other people in the Democratic field that you can tell us about? Because, I mean, let me ask you this. Does Deidre Abood have a chance being a Muslim in a country that's in a state that's famous for its sort of anti-xenophobic kind of immigration policies, et cetera? So,
I'd like to be charitable and say that there is a chance. It's hard to imagine what it would look like if that were the outcome. I think that she has a very small chance, extremely close to zero chance of winning the Senate seat. There has been talk about another Democrat perhaps running. There was talk about Kyrsten Sinema. who's in the House now, a Democrat who represents Central Phoenix. There was talk about whether or not she might take this opportunity to run. There's also talk about the mayor of Phoenix getting into that race. So I think we'll wait and see kind of what shakes out, especially with the McCain stuff. And then there will probably be some news. I imagine that the Democrats will want to have somebody that people are more familiar with.
So there's no kind of Democratic star there or anybody that... I mean, there's a pretty good congressman, is there not? A former vet that seems to be getting a lot of attention.
Sure. So that is Congressman Ruben Gallego, and he's a younger guy. He's a veteran, Democrat, Hispanic. He represents one of the Voting Rights Act protected minority-majority districts in South Phoenix. And traditionally, congressmen representing those districts have not translated into statewide elections because while they have an easy time in a heavily minority area, the state is not a majority-minority district or area, and therefore they just don't have the same dynamic at play. So that would be probably a tough sell for especially 2018. It's much more plausible to think about somebody like Kyrsten Sinema, who comes from a competitive or relatively competitive district where it's, maybe it favors Democrats by 4%, I think. But it's easier to imagine somebody like that who also has a track record for raising a lot of money to translate into what is a somewhat competitive statewide election.
Well, Evan Wyloge, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
All right, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Evan Wyloge, who's an investigative reporter with the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting, who covers politics and government in Arizona with a focus on watchdog data and accountability journalism. He previously spent 5 years as a reporter at the Arizona Capital Times. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and Clemence Pernard. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.